Have you ever found yourself nodding along to a self-help guru's advice, only to realize later that their simple solution didn't actually solve your complex problem? You're not alone. We live in an age where the multi-billion dollar self-improvement industry has infiltrated every aspect of our lives, promising transformation through 5 simple steps or 7 effective habits. From talent shows featuring contestants' personal journeys to best-selling books that have sold tens of millions of copies, psychological concepts have become the invisible scaffolding for how we approach our lives. This cultural shift has been so complete that we rarely pause to examine whether these ideas actually help us or whether they're creating impossible expectations that leave us feeling perpetually inadequate. As Oscar Wilde noted, the truth is rarely pure and never simple. Yet simplicity is precisely what most self-help books promise in a world growing increasingly complex. Low self-esteem is the root of all your problems. This mantra has become so deeply embedded in our culture that we rarely question it. Self-help gurus like Jack Canfield declare self-esteem a necessity for anyone who has important goals, while countless books, workshops, and therapy sessions focus on boosting self-image as the primary path to success. But is this really true? Do we always deserve to feel good about ourselves? The evidence suggests this widely accepted belief deserves careful scrutiny. While abuse and neglect certainly damage people's sense of self-worth, many use low self-esteem as a convenient excuse for passivity or to elicit sympathy when action would serve them better. Someone might blame poor self-esteem for not applying to better jobs, approaching potential romantic partners, or pursuing ambitious goals. Research reveals something even more troubling. High self-esteem often creates delusion rather than accuracy. Those rating themselves highly aren't necessarily viewed the same way by peers or objective measures. Studies show that students who rate their academic abilities highest often perform worse than more modest peers. Programs targeting self-esteem to improve academic performance have yielded consistently disappointing results. California's famous self-esteem initiative in schools during the 1980s failed to produce any meaningful improvements in student achievement or behavior. And contrary to popular belief, bullies typically have inflated rather than damaged self-images. They're not compensating for insecurity. They genuinely believe they're superior to others and feel entitled to dominate peers. Research by psychologist Roy Baumeister found that aggressive individuals typically maintain unrealistically positive views of themselves. Self-esteem doesn't reliably predict relationship quality or prevent risky behaviors either. Studies show no correlation between self-esteem levels and relationship satisfaction, and high self-esteem can actually enable destructive choices by convincing people they're immune to consequences. Throughout most of human history, excessive self-love was considered dangerous, not virtuous. Ancient Greeks warned against hubris as a fatal flaw, while Christianity emphasized humility as a core virtue. Traditional Buddhist and Taoist teachings similarly caution against attachment to ego. Perhaps self-esteem works better as feedback about our choices than as a prerequisite for achievement. Meaningful self-worth comes from actual accomplishment, from doing things that deserve respect, not from unearned praise or empty affirmations. When we put the cart before the horse by demanding self-esteem before achievement, we create a foundation built on sand. True confidence emerges naturally from developing real skills, maintaining integrity, and contributing value to others. Rather than obsessing over how we feel about ourselves, we might focus more on becoming people worthy of our own respect through consistent, positive action. Let your feelings out! This advice has become psychological gospel, transforming the once valued British stiff upper lip into something viewed as psychologically harmful. Reality TV stars like Jade Goody exemplify our cultural shift toward emotional transparency. Being authentic means being emotionally expressive. Yet Goody's story serves as a cautionary tale. Her unfiltered emotions eventually led to her downfall during Celebrity Big Brother when her outbursts toward Shilpa Shetty caused international controversy. Similar incidents, from public meltdowns of celebrities to viral videos of emotional outbursts, demonstrate how unchecked emotional expression can damage reputations and relationships. The idea that repressed emotions are dangerous stems largely from Freud's hydraulic model of the mind, where buried feelings create pressure that manifests as neurotic symptoms. Some research supports this view. Dr. George Solomon found people who repress feelings face higher risks of certain physical ailments, including compromised immune function and increased susceptibility to stress-related disorders. Studies have linked emotional suppression to higher blood pressure, increased heart rate, and elevated cortisol levels. Yet contradictions exist. Japan, where emotional suppression is culturally encouraged, boasts exceptional health outcomes and longevity. Similarly, many Asian cultures that value emotional restraint show lower rates of anxiety and depression than more expressive Western societies. Studies after 9/11 revealed that those who didn't express their feelings fared better psychologically than those who did. This finding challenged the conventional wisdom about trauma processing. Research by James Pennebaker and others has shown that while writing about emotions can be therapeutic, forced emotional expression can be counterproductive. Similarly, research shows that venting anger often intensifies rather than reduces it, supporting Darwin's 1872 observation that the free expression by outward signs of an emotion intensifies it. This phenomenon has been demonstrated in numerous studies where participants who were encouraged to vent anger through aggressive activities actually became more aggressive afterward. Our emotions aren't always spontaneous truth-tellers, but are often manipulated by societal feeling rules that dictate appropriate emotional responses. These rules vary across cultures and contexts. What's considered healthy emotional expression in an American context might be viewed as inappropriate in other societies. Social media has further complicated this landscape, creating new pressures for emotional performance and authenticity while simultaneously making the consequences of emotional outbursts more permanent and far-reaching. While repressing emotions can be harmful, there's a crucial difference between acknowledging feelings and expressing them without restraint. Evolution gave us higher brain functions to moderate our emotional responses. The line between emotional expressivity and emotional incontinence is one we should carefully observe. Research in emotional intelligence suggests that the most successful individuals are those who can recognize and process their emotions while choosing appropriate ways and times to express them. Perhaps the healthiest approach lies somewhere between Victorian repression and reality TV-style emotional incontinence, emphasizing mindful awareness and selective expression rather than either complete suppression or unfiltered release. Daniel Goleman has popularized the idea that emotional intelligence matters more for success than cognitive abilities. According to him, close to 90% of success among top leaders comes from emotional intelligence. This claim has resonated deeply in corporate culture, spawning countless training programs, self-help books, and leadership seminars. It's a comforting thought that being emotionally aware and empathetic matters more than raw intellectual horsepower. But scientific evidence tells a different story. Van Roy and Viswavaran's 2004 comprehensive review, analyzing data from over 69 independent studies, found only a marginal correlation, around 0.23, between EQ and professional achievement, with conventional IQ proving far more reliable in predicting success, showing correlations of 0.51 or higher. The concept itself has evolved from Salovey and Mayer's specific definition focused on emotional processing abilities into a nebulous hybrid of abilities, personality traits, and interpersonal skills that some argue lack scientific rigor. Critics like Hans Eisenscheck and Jordan Peterson argue the concept lacks coherence, noting that adaptive behaviors aren't necessarily intelligent ones. For instance, a salesperson might effectively manipulate emotions to close deals without truly understanding or processing emotions intelligently. The values promoted by emotional intelligence suspiciously align with corporate interests, creating compliant employees rather than innovative leaders or disruptive thinkers. This has led some researchers to suggest that EQ might be more about conformity than actual emotional capability. Look at history's great achievers. Bill Gates was known for his aggressive management style. Steve Jobs was infamously difficult to work with. Winston Churchill was often depressed and combative. And Thomas Edison was notoriously harsh with employees. These titans of industry and history were hardly exemplars of the emotionally intelligent individual Goleman describes as poised and outgoing, committed to people and causes, sympathetic and caring. Many were difficult, demanding, and sometimes downright unpleasant, yet their achievements are undeniable. While ethical, empathic leadership is admirable, emotional intelligence isn't the golden ticket to professional advancement that self-help literature suggests. Research from organizations like Google, Project Oxygen, has found that while interpersonal skills matter, technical expertise and cognitive ability remain crucial predictors of success. As Machiavelli understood, how we live is so different from how we ought to live. The biographies of outstanding achievers rarely align with the traits celebrated as emotional intelligence. From Edison's ruthless business tactics to Henry Ford's stubborn authoritarianism, history suggests that achievement often comes from a complex mix of traits, not all of them pleasant or politically correct. Perhaps we should be more honest about what actually drives success rather than what we wish would drive it. Like the family in Michael Rosen's We're Going on a Bear Hunt, who enthusiastically pursue their objective until confronting the actual bear, our goal setting can lead us toward outcomes we don't truly want. Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert reveals we're remarkably poor at predicting what will make us happy. Whether material purchases or life changes typically deliver less satisfaction than anticipated and for shorter periods. Ironically, while we often cope better with major life crises than expected because our psychological defenses activate, chronic minor irritations can have a more detrimental cumulative effect because we remain undefended against them. The advice to not sweat the small stuff may actually be misguided. Setting unrealistic stretch goals can be counterproductive for many people. While such ambitious targets might motivate those already experiencing success, they can be crushing for those with weaker track records. Research shows people achieve stretch goals only about 10% of the time, and successive failures create a downward spiral of declining performance, motivation, and confidence. Goals can also dangerously narrow our attention, causing us to miss important contextual information, much like participants in the Simons-Chabra selective attention task who fail to notice a gorilla while counting basketball passes. This tunnel vision can encourage risky behavior, neglect of relationships, and a distorted sense of priority. Perhaps most toxic is the implication that we're never quite enough as we are, when research shows high achievers are generally no happier than others. Contentment, accepting what we have rather than constantly striving for more, may be a more reliable path to happiness, as gratitude studies have consistently shown. Sometimes the wisest goal is having fewer goals. No one can make you feel anything without your permission. This popular self-help mantra sounds empowering but fundamentally misrepresents how our emotions actually work. Research consistently shows how profoundly we're influenced by others without awareness. Rosenthal's classroom experiment demonstrated how teacher expectations alone significantly affected student performance. When teachers were told certain students were gifted, these students showed marked improvement regardless of their actual initial abilities. Alex Pentland's reality mining studies at MIT revealed a subliminal level of interaction between people that's more reliable in predicting outcomes than conversation content, showing how subtle social signals influence everything from negotiation results to dating success. Non-conscious mimicry plays a crucial role in emotional contagion. We tend to copy others' body language, facial expressions, and speech patterns, which directly impacts our emotions. Studies show that merely watching someone smile activates the same facial muscles in observers, triggering similar emotional states. Even feelings like loneliness can be contagious across neighborhoods, spreading through social networks like a virus. Research has found that if your friend's friend becomes lonely, your chances of experiencing loneliness increase by 15%, even if you've never met that person. Our brains are neurologically configured with mirror neurons that activate when we observe others' emotions, predisposing us to feel their pain or share their joy. This system is so refined that we can detect micro-expressions lasting less than a fifth of a second, allowing us to unconsciously pick up on others' emotional states. Brain imaging studies show that witnessing someone experience pain activates many of the same neural circuits as experiencing pain firsthand. Rather than believing we control our emotional responses to others, we should recognize our vulnerability to unconscious social influence and make thoughtful choices about our company. This means being strategic about our social environments, choosing to spend time with people who uplift us, limiting exposure to chronic complainers, and creating boundaries with those who consistently trigger negative emotions. We should also be mindful of our own impact on others, considering how we might contribute to emotional pollution in our environments through our moods, attitudes, and behavioral patterns. While sometimes uncomfortable, our spontaneous reactions to others are an essential part of being fully alive. The idea that we should maintain complete emotional independence denies our fundamentally social nature. Research in developmental psychology shows that healthy emotional regulation actually develops through relationship, not in isolation. Perhaps true emotional maturity isn't about being impervious to others' influence, but about acknowledging our interconnectedness while maintaining our core values. This means developing the wisdom to recognize when we're being influenced, the discernment to choose our social environments wisely, and the ability to stay grounded in our authentic selves while remaining open to meaningful emotional connections with others. The latent dangers of positive thinking are revealed in its disturbing parallels with criminal mindsets. Criminologists note that offenders often display an overvalued sense of entitlement, precisely what positive thinking teachings encourage through their name-it-and-claim-it approach. This mindset manifests in beliefs like, "I deserve success without effort," or "the universe owes me abundance," which mirror the thought patterns of many convicted criminals who believe rules don't apply to them. Most positive affirmations focus exclusively on the self rather than others' needs or the greater good, potentially fostering narcissistic tendencies. The psychological inventory of criminal thinking styles identifies several patterns in repeat offenders that mirror extreme positive thinking: dissociating from negative emotions, like positive thinking's tendency to silence unwanted feelings; maintaining absolute control over one's environment, similar to mind-over-matter philosophies like The Secret; and super-optimism that generates unrealistic confidence regardless of obstacles. For instance, career criminals often maintain unwavering optimism about avoiding capture, just as devoted positive thinkers might ignore clear warning signs in business or relationships. Positive thinking can also foster cognitive indolence, an uncritical attitude toward one's thoughts and impoverished problem-solving skills. This manifests in various ways: refusing to consider contingency plans, dismissing valid criticism as negative energy, or avoiding necessary but uncomfortable conversations. While optimistic people can be great company, excessive positivity leads to denial and fantasy rather than confronting reality. Consider the entrepreneur who refuses to acknowledge market changes, or the investor who ignores risk factors while maintaining blind faith and success. This isn't to suggest we should all become pessimists. Rather, we need a balanced approach that acknowledges both positive and negative aspects of reality. Negative emotions serve important functions. Anxiety warns us of danger, sadness helps us process loss, and guilt signals when we violated our own moral code. For example, appropriate anxiety might prevent a risky investment, while healthy sadness following a relationship's end allows proper emotional processing. A society that pathologizes these normal human experiences creates psychological fragility rather than strength. The author warns against our headlong rush toward mandatory positivity, where negative thinking might become a thought crime, and advocates for a balanced middle ground that acknowledges the full spectrum of human emotion. This toxic positivity is increasingly evident in workplace cultures that demand constant enthusiasm, social media's pressure for perpetual happiness, and self-help materials that demonize negative thoughts. Perhaps true emotional intelligence isn't about being positive all the time, but about having the right emotion for the situation, whether that's appropriate anger at injustice, necessary caution in risky situations, or genuine joy in moments of achievement. The phrase, "we need to talk," typically triggers dread, revealing our instinctive wariness about relationship discussions. While talking can help, psychobabble has created the misconception that most relationship tensions stem from communication failure. The author distinguishes between merely talking and truly communicating. Often our problems arise not from poor communication, but from communicating our hurt, anger, and rejection all too effectively through nonverbal channels we barely control. Alex Pentland's research on the second channel of communication shows how our true feelings leak through minute fluctuations in movements, tone, and non-conscious mimicry that happens faster than conscious processing. When couples talk, both parties typically want validation of their worldview, not just behavioral changes. Each person essentially wants the other to adopt their perspective, which would force their partner to accept an undesirable role in that narrative. This creates a negotiation where concessions threaten identity itself, breeding resentment even when superficial agreement is reached. Rather than endless verbal processing, the author suggests focusing on what truly connects people, making each other feel good through positive emotions and validation. Physical touch, even simple hand-holding, releases bonding hormones like oxytocin that can heal relationship rifts more effectively than words. The representations we hold of people are incredibly powerful, influencing both our behavior and theirs in profound ways. Stephen Covey illustrated this when he realized his negative perception of his struggling son as inadequate was the real problem, not his son's abilities. By challenging this inadequate image, Covey and his wife helped their son become confident and capable. When relationship conflicts arise, your psychological task is to be the standard bearer of a positive image of your loved one. Remind yourself of their qualities you first admired and mentally rehearse good times together. Research shows couples who unrealistically idealize their partners report higher marital satisfaction. Sometimes the most effective communication happens not through words, but through the stories we choose to tell ourselves about the person we love. Cognitive behavioral therapy has become the therapy of choice for many, touted as a cost-effective, evidence-based treatment for numerous conditions. Its central premise, that changing how we think changes how we feel, has undoubtedly helped many people. However, despite its popularity, CBT's effectiveness may be more modest than commonly believed. While CBT has been proactive about measuring outcomes, the results aren't as dramatic as often assumed. A meta-analysis of CBT for anxiety disorders found an effect size of only 0.33, meaning 3/4 of treated patients would still experience symptoms in the range of untreated patients. Some studies suggest long-term psychotherapy may actually be better for chronic depression or complex cases, despite being ignored by institutions favoring quick, cheap treatments. Research consistently shows that the quality of your relationship with your therapist contributes about 30% to therapy's effectiveness, while specific techniques account for only 15%. Multiple studies confirmed that the therapeutic relationship impacts improvement as much as any particular treatment method. CBT theoretically presents thoughts, feelings, physiological reactions, and behaviors as equally influential in a system of mutual cause and effect. Yet in practice, it focuses predominantly on thoughts, promoting a top-down model where the head should rule the heart. This creates the misplaced assumption that thoughts are always the root cause of emotions and can reliably subdue unwanted feelings. Research shows our brains initiate actions 300 milliseconds before we're conscious of deciding to move, suggesting conscious experience may be too slow to truly govern our responses. We also have two brains, our cranial brain and the enteric gut brain, with 100 million neurons that operates independently, with 90% of vagus nerve fibers sending information up rather than down. Our conscious thoughts may have little leverage over what our gut is screaming at us. CBT's tendency to label uncomfortable thoughts as irrational ignores that sometimes our most paranoid interpretations are correct. It also underestimates how our unconscious mind, which operates without logic or causality, drives our behavior. When threatened, our primitive reptilian brain takes over, shutting down the higher centers needed for rational thought. Perhaps we need approaches that acknowledge the limits of rational thinking rather than overestimating its power. The notion of a consistent core self may be illusory. Despite our personal narratives creating a sense of continuity, we heavily edit experiences that don't fit our official life story. Looking at old photos reveals how foreign our past selves appear. Modern life requires shifting through multiple settings and roles, at work, with children, with friends. Some sociologists, like Kenneth Gergen, embrace this pastiche personality, suggesting we should borrow identity pieces as needed rather than seeking a true self. Our beliefs, values, and even personalities appear less stable than we think. Studies show personality traits change significantly over time, and even bilingual people present different personality profiles depending on which language they're using. Perhaps instead of seeking an integrated real self, we might embrace Walt Whitman's view, "I am large, I contain multitudes." Therapists Hal and Sidra Stone developed voice dialogue to help patients recognize their different subpersonalities, suggesting we might benefit from acknowledging our multiple selves rather than forcing an illusion of integration. This perspective might change how we view mental illness. Perhaps some of ourselves are healthier than others, and recovery involves choosing which selves we inhabit. Therapist Andres Anyal proposed the ambiguous gestalt theory, suggesting healthy and neurotic selves aren't opposite ends of a spectrum, but alternative arrangements of the same mental factors, like different patterns in a kaleidoscope. The same trait might manifest as social withdrawal in the neurotic configuration or thoughtful reflection in the healthy one. This explains how clients like Diana can shift dramatically between depressed and vibrant states during therapy sessions, eventually learning to inhabit her healthier self more consistently. Rather than viewing therapy as a grinding journey, sometimes healing involves accessing an adjacent room in your mind, a different version of yourself that's already formed. Perhaps the search for authenticity isn't about finding a single real you, but about recognizing and integrating your many authentic selves.